Welcome to Photography Insights, the show that interviews people from the photography world. I'm your host, Andrew Walmsley, and today we have an excellent film and Polaroid photographer for you. Stephen Mayer Rasso is what is known as a digital artist, as his day job involves in designing book covers and artwork for people. But during his free time, he's an advocate of film and loves the square format. But not just film, Stephen shoots and loves Polaroid too, and has a variety of work to showcase and discuss. He's a lovely and open person who freely discusses his work and passion, and we actually met through one of my Kodak competitions over a year ago now, and one of his photographs had a lasting effect on me. So in this one we discuss Judge Dredd, book covers, digital manipulation, Polaroid frustrations, abstractness, simplicity, collages, and film. And of course, Stephen is also put through our random questions to find out why he wants to punch Steven Seagal. But before I move you on, I have some amazing and exciting news. For those who follow me on social media will already know this one. I'm finally proud to tell you all my first body of work is available to buy. I've been very humbled by Static Age wanting to print this work and his constant encouragement, to be honest. You all know, and I'm an advocate of the printed medium, so having something out there myself is pretty incredible, to be honest. Now, not everyone realises simply how much this achievement means to me on a personal level, so I'm going to open up. My background is very humble. I'm from a poor family. I was an average student, brought up with a mixture of great people and not so great due to the locations I lived in. I plodded along in life for many years and always felt like something was missing. Photography changed all that and has allowed me to talk to you all, share my love, passion and zest for life. And hopefully it's the start of a new chapter. Now the zine is only £4 and that is delivered, so it's very affordable, and I can't thank Pete at Static enough for getting this new format and new pricing structure. Honestly, it's incredible. So even if you can't afford to buy it, I'd appreciate anyone sharing the link and I'll be eternally grateful. And as of this week, Pete's own zine is out as well. I've purchased it myself because I really love what Pete does personally, so I hope you'll engage with that as well. He's a fabulous guy, and what he's doing with the label is really, really good. So do check that out. There aren't many copies left, to be honest, but you never know what will happen. So thank you for all listening to that. And obviously, anyone who wants to help the cause in another way, there's always the donation route on my Ko-fi page. So there's a link on my website for that. And obviously, please do check out our friends of the show, like Film Dev and Chroma Camera. Otherwise, I'm so happy and excited. So I'm sure you can appreciate how I feel at the minute. It's a big, big thing. Seeing your work out there and seeing the responses from my friends supporting me, it's just mega. I'll leave you all and I'll play the music and let's await our lovely guest Stephen. And welcome to the show, Steve. How are you?
I'm very well, Andy. Thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Like I said to you before, it's not something I've really done in the past, so this is a real treat here.
No, it's really nice because obviously I've been following your work a while now, and we'll get to that in a minute. I think what we've been talking about, everybody, is a few little things like embracing so many different mediums and just going through it with so many different things, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's definitely been something that's been, I don't know whether it's been important to me, but it's just been part of this path of photography that I guess I've been on for a few years now.
Just a few.
I mean, I started, young as a teenager. I'm 40 now, so it's been a good, couple of decades plus that I've, in some way, shape, or form, held a camera in my hands on pretty much, most days, I guess, at least once a week, I suppose. And part of that path of discovery has been trying lots of different things, and it's something that I've enjoyed, and what has sort of brought me, from film to digital to try and see what that brings, and then brought me back to film while still shooting digital, and all the different processes and, different techniques that are involved with it. It's something really nice, I think, that photography can give us these many options of image making and how we interact with our world around us.
Yeah, and I think it's really nice the fact that you're talking about all mediums as well, because obviously I originally knew you through your film work, but now I know you like you're a digital artist as well. So, some people could say that's a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? But we're from a different world, aren't
It's like Jekyll and Hyde, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes people are surprised that I sort of operate in these two, well, to some people they are separate worlds, but for me they're really not, because it's all part of creative output and of image making. I mean, ultimately, I think I don't call myself a photographer really, and I don't really call myself a graphic designer. I sort of prefer the term image making, because that's kind of what I do. I sort of make images. Sometimes they're with cameras, sometimes they're with computers, or little doodles, or I used to actually do some spray painting stuff as well. So it's just stuff that makes an image, just, and I think that's always excited me, this, opportunity that we have of interacting with our world and ourselves within that world with the medium of picture making. Yeah.
I mean, it was really interesting to see your graphical work as well. Seeing that you'd done covers for books, and then we saw the games, and I was, we was looking through the other, like I was saying to you, Judge Dredd. I mean, like Judge Dredd to me was a fantastic memory as a teenager. I had
Yeah.
hordes of 2000 AD comics.
Yeah. I was never a massive 2000 AD fan myself, but I had friends of mine that were really into it, and they, I mean, still even subscribe and get the comic sent, So I, when the opportunity came to work with, an IP such as Judge Dredd, it was, yeah, it's amazing. It's really, really nice, and there's one of the current artists, Rufus Dayglow, he's called, or calls himself, who still works on the Judge Dredd stuff, and it's amazing to sort of take someone's illustration who is, so well, known in that world, and then be given that to sort of work your graphic design skills around that. Yeah, I mean, what you're referencing is a card game there, yeah, that we did a couple of years ago while I was still working at a games company in Oxford called Osprey Games.
Osprey games, right, makes sense. Yeah, there's quite a few games there, weren't there? And then obviously there were so many nice book covers, that they're very visually appealing, aren't they?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of hard for yourself to sort of agree with that all the time, I guess, because you don't want to sound, pretentious or vain or anything. And it's, sometimes it's a struggle of even, putting these things together, because you've got your ideas and the authors have got their ideas and the publishers have got their ideas and the agent's got their ideas. So yeah, but I seem to have been lucky enough to sort of have a sort of visual style that works in a particular arena. Most of that is fiction, and a lot of that's for a younger audience. Well, so I do a lot of sort of young adult fiction, and I think, I guess, the sort of, yeah, the digital manipulation stuff that I've done over the years, the sort of composite Photoshop work, lends itself very well to that. Yeah, and it's something I genuinely enjoy. I kind of quite like taking things, ripping them apart, and then putting them back together, which is kind of what composite photography is, I suppose. So yeah, it was very early on, when Photoshop first came about, I was interested, because I was like, okay, I can see this being a thing, and I can see this, you know, being something that can give me opportunities down the line, creatively and work-wise as well.
Mm. It, you know, they are beautiful. You can see there's a certain style to them all. How does it work with that sort of work then? Do you get approached by the publisher, the author, or how does it work?
So I mean, it's different, you know. Sometimes it will be authors that have seen the work because they're friends with other authors, or it's publishers that have been, you know, given my details, or going to have seen things that are in a similar category that they're trying to, you know, publish into, and they're just aware of other books that I may have been working on. Mm. I do a lot of work for the US as well, funnily enough, and I think a lot of my sort of Photoshop work is quite, it sort of maybe has a more American feel than a European feel. I've been told this before anyway, so it's not something that sort of, that maybe that statement comes from myself, but yeah, but I think there's definitely a couple of publishers in the US that I seem to have return business from, and they sort of seem to like my work. And I'm fortunate enough that, you know, I live in a time where nowadays that is totally an option. I mean, even before, you know, COVID came along, I was, you know, working in the UK for publishers in the US, and it's be able to, you know, do that nowadays. You know, even, you know, 25 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case, really.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's different work, but it's nice, isn't it? Because you're obviously still using this visual means. You've got ideas, you know how to light. So for me, it's a bit like photography in one sense, but you're just applying your skill in a different way, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of my, you know, the stuff that you've seen that I do, you know, book cover wise, maybe not so much on the games, I guess, because they are more illustration based or typography based, and even some of the book covers is more typographic. But a lot of the stuff that I do composite work on for book covers is, it starts with photography. I mean, that's the thing, you know. I'm not a painter or an illustrator or a digital artist per se, but I know how to manipulate photography because it's something that I've grown up with, taking pictures. And at some point I started, you know, even before digital cameras were a thing, I just put them on a scanner, scanned them in, and started, you know, cutting them out with the wizard wand in Photoshop, you know, even early versions, you know, when layers came along, I think in sort of Photoshop, oh, I don't know, was it Photoshop 4 or maybe earlier? You know, again, this is sort of 90s stuff, late 90s. I was like, wow, this is great, you know. And immediately I sort of thought of these, like, possibilities, like, sort of visualizing in my head of these, like, layers of acetate that I could manipulate and move around and, you know, kind of put into separate orders, kind of opened up a new world of sort of engaging with imagery and manipulating these images to become something quite, yeah, otherworldly, I suppose. Yeah. And with book covers, I think I realized quite early on that I wanted to be able to get to a point with the digital manipulation stuff, so the kind of my day job, you know, as a graphic designer, that I knew I needed to get to a point where I could manipulate to a brief. So if someone said, you know, we need a book cover of, you know, a girl holding a lantern running up a hill or all this, I knew I had to be able to put that together somehow, you know. Even back then, you know, there were stock options available, but, you know, nowadays you've got plenty to choose from if you go on, you know, stock sites. But back when I first started this, it was usually easier to just go, I'll use my girlfriend and we'll get a lantern and we'll, you know, do it, and then I'll just cut it out and do all the heavy lifting in Photoshop in a way, because I didn't have money to hire studios or get proper lights. I was losing, you know, like literally desk lamps, or, you know, like the sort of halogen lights that I, you know, you get from B&Q for like a tenner that you use in your garage on your car, kind of a thing. So yeah, it's sort of making ends meet, and especially when you're starting out, something like Photoshop is great, because as long as you can run that, the world's your oyster in a way. Then it's just down to developing the skill, and you can obviously see what other people and peers are doing, and you go, okay, I need to get to a point where someone can tell me what they want in an image, and I can produce that image for them.
Yeah, No, that's interesting. The main thing about getting you on here was to talk about your film work, and it's hard to know where to start because you've actually done a variety, haven't you? Of like black and white, long exposures, there's your Polaroids, a bit of dark room. I mean, when I saw the Polaroids, I was like, God, this is really interesting because, like I say to you, I never really associated Polaroid really with nice colours or patterns. And you've done these like lovely swirling circular type shapes. They're beautiful.
Thanks. I mean, that's kind of interesting to hear. Like, just as a quick question then, when you say, you don't associate Polaroid with nice colors, what sort of sticks in your head when you do hear Polaroid?
I
Because I
think,
think I know what it is, but I think I kind of want to hear it before I sort of
yeah, I
give my
think,
take on how I see it and how it came into my sort of creative endeavors.
I see it as duller colors, less tones, not saturated as well, and either blown or very understated. There was never sort of any middle ground.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're not wrong. I think that is definitely the sort of hallmark of a lot of Polaroids that have been shot over the decades. And in a funny sort of a way, I think that's what sort of intrigued me about it to start with. And in fact, it really was Polaroid that brought me back to film photography. So I started out, like I said to you before this, I started shooting as a teenager in the 90s and then sort of started being more serious about it. And I, for my 18th birthday, I asked for an SLR camera. So I got some Minolta Dynax something 505 SI, something like that. It wasn't not a great camera. So one of those like 90s SLRs that was quite plasticky. Had fully automated control, so you could just bung the film in and it would advance it for you automatically. And it's got a meter and you can just shoot it as a point and shoot basically. But you can also put it in manual mode and start messing around with aperture and shutter speed and focus and all this stuff. So I was intrigued by that. And I then started, sort of taking a photography course at college, and they gave us Pentax K1000s, I remember. And I sort of immediately loved these cameras. I kind of fell in love with the medium then. And then, kept shooting throughout my sort of late teens and early 20s, went to college, did the graphic design degree, came out of that, started working, and I'm now doing what I'm doing. And over the years of working in design and digital image manipulation, I sort of fondly remembered those days in the dark room and messing around with the film and the whole sort of physicality of the medium. And I think I've forgotten how much I missed that. And it was on a trip to the States, 4 years ago, maybe, when my wife and I went. And this is where Polaroid comes in. It's a bit of a tenuous one, but anyway, I bought a Polaroid camera while we were on holiday. And we used to have Polaroids as a kid. Again, my mum had them. That's what she liked to shoot on because it's kind of easy and instant, and you can bap it down in an album or stick it on the fridge. And I bought a Polaroid camera, and it sort of immediately took me back to that equal amount of joy and frustration that film photography can have, especially Polaroid, because you've got very little control over your exposure. I mean, on most Polaroid cameras, you have a button to eject the picture, and then you have a dial to either make it slightly lighter or slightly darker. But I mean, you don't know what it's going to do anyway, so you're sort of guessing to start with and shooting a shot. All right, that's not great, and you've got to wait your 10 15 minutes before you can even look at it properly. And then if you're shooting something that you can reshoot to go, okay, I'll make it lighter or darker, if Polaroid film isn't that reliable, so it's not to say that I won't massively overexpose or massively underexpose, and then depending on how the film has been kept, something we spoke about before as well. It's way more important with Polaroid film to keep it at a constant refrigerator temperature. So keep it in the fridge. Your normal film, your sort of color film and black and white film, not quite so important. But yeah, so shooting the Polaroids again sort of reminded me of, wow, there's this whole thing that I used to do, and it used to in equal measures excite and frustrate. And I was sort of immediately hooked on it again. And it was from there that I then started dusting off my old film cameras and then acquiring a few more in the process. I'd never shot medium format before at college because it was always, you know, kind of here's a 35 mil camera, it's cheap and it's cheerful, and we'll give you a canister of film, run with it. And I always liked the look of pictures I saw when I sort of knew what I was looking at, and I go, why is it like this? You know, why is that depth of field in the way that it is? And why is the picture always square? People go, well, that's medium format and it's 6x6. And I go, okay, right. So I want to give that a try. And again, funnily enough, Polaroid sort of was that catalyst where I like the square picture of the Polaroid with that, you know, classic whiteboard around it. And I go, yeah, I want to do more of this, but maybe have a little bit more control. So, you know, I got a secondhand Yashica mat that I started shooting with, and I loved it, immediately loved it. I was like, wow, this is a thing that I've always wanted to do that I haven't been doing so far. You know, the whole top-down waist level viewfinder and all of this sort of gadgetry that comes along with it, light meters and all this stuff, and loading the film, and it just has this real appeal to me. And yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Polaroid, because it was literally the sort of segue for me back from digital into film photography. And I still shoot Polaroids. I love it. I love the fact that it's so finite. You know, you have, even with film photography, you have, you know, you develop the film and you have an influence over how that looks by what developer you use, and when you print it, the paper you use, and how long you, and what you can manipulate in the darkroom. You can still, you know, when you process it and scan it, you then still have, I mean, you need to, for example, color, it obviously comes out with that, you know, yellow orangey cast. You need to invert it first and then correct the colors as per the stock that you're using. So you're still editing in a way, whereas Polaroid, there's none of that. You press the button and what comes out is what you get.
It's
And
different.
it really makes, or it really made me try and both be less technical about my photography and just try and find joy in composition. And it also made me try and simplify my compositions by going, okay, we're not going to have dynamic range because it might just be totally blown out or totally dark. You know, I'm just going to look for something much simpler, compositionally speaking, when I'm shooting Polaroids than with anything else. That I just kind of focus on, yeah, you know, shapes or shadows and, you know, that kind of a thing, you know, and just things like that I know in a way will make for an appealing image, even if it isn't technically perfect.
I would say it's probably abstract, wouldn't you? Them couple of images are picked out.
Yeah, out of the stuff that you picked out, definitely, yeah. And I think I enjoy approaching Polaroid from a more abstract point of view. And it's funny in a way, because I think, you know, my wife actually, she shoots Fuji Instax, so it's a slightly smaller format, because she got annoyed with me that I never took my Polaroids out when we were going out to, you know, on holiday or stuff like that, whereas I just shoot these sort of weird little pictures with it. And she was like, why don't you take pictures of stuff that we can stick on the fridge, you know? And for some reason, or for a reason I just explained, I suppose, I saw the limits of the medium as something to embrace, and I kind of go, you know what? I kind of like seeking out these slightly more abstract images. Yeah, I kind of like the fact that I have very little control over it, and in a way that plays into it, because you go, well, it's abstract, so yeah, you know, I'm going to be happy if I can see something, but it's massively blown out or underexposed. I still get a joy out of seeing an instant picture. And there's something very humbling, I think, for myself as a photographer, of, like I said, this sort of finite image that you don't really have a chance to mess with it too much afterwards, you know? I mean, I know people do, because you can still cut them out and collage them or whatever, you know. People stick them in the microwave and let them bubble up, and all this stuff will do, you know, emulsion lifts, and you can do fancy stuff, sure. But I don't really do that, and I just like this, like, one-stop shop that it does. It's so the opposite of what I do in my day job, of having to do a lot of detail-oriented corrections or manipulations on very minute things, that it's nice to just go, it's a square, something will appear in it, point the camera at something that looks good, and try and make something out of abstract shapes.
It is. It's really interesting, in that sense, and the idea that it got you onto film, because obviously your film works lovely as well, and it's how we sort of come across each other, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah.
This famous shot at, for anyone Listen, it is a famous place near Blackpool on the west coast of the UK. I didn't know anything about it till I saw your photo, and I was like, where is this? And what would you call that structure?
You mean that sort of shell-like
Yeah.
sculpture in the sea? Yeah, it's called Mary's Shell, I believe. It's a piece of like land art, basically, I guess is what it's called, you know, sort of
Okay.
installation land art. So I, you know, I'm afraid to say I don't know the artist or whether it is even credited an artist. It must be. My wife's family live up in Blackpool, so we go quite often. We used to anyway before COVID hit and all this. So I'd be out at the sea anyway taking pictures, and it's interesting because it is totally submerged at high tide and entirely visible at low tide. I'm often amazed that that's even allowed from a health and safety perspective, because it is, you know, a proper metal structure with hard edges, and you know, if you were swimming, you'd definitely cut yourself. But so it has this whole life cycle as well during the day, where you can't see it at all, and then you can see like a little bit at the top, kind of a thing, and then you get to a point where you can see all of it in the sand, and parts that I always quite like when there's some water at the bottom and it sort of reflects and it sort of creates almost this figure of eight sometimes, you know, when the light is right. It definitely sort of plays into my love for long exposure, which is again something that I've always sort of had a fascination with. And I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it does, yeah, it does. It certainly works well at the seaside, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we picked it out, didn't we? Because it was a fabulous image, and I think because of where it is, like you're saying, you did a long exposure. It's got this like peaceful feeling to it, even though it's a big structure and it's the sea and the shell. But I mean, how big is it?
I mean it's taller than myself, and I don't really know how tall I am, but like I'm not the tallest of guys, so I'd say it probably stands a good like 2 3 meters tall. Like definitely bigger than human anyway.
No, that's
I mean,
interesting.
on a bright sunny day when the tide has gone out, you just, you know, you see kids playing in it and they're sort of climbing all over it, and parents telling them off to come down from that, and you know, don't get cut and all this. But it is an amazing thing. I mean in a way it's, you know, I've taken some nice pictures of it, and as have a lot of other people, to be honest, because
Yeah, of
it just
course,
in
yeah.
itself it's such a nice piece of art anyway, that I think it lends itself really well to photography. What I quite like is when I see it done, like, I mean, I like shooting it in black and white, because I think it contrasts so well with the kind of calmness of a long exposure as well, and to have that separation of black subject and white ocean and sky that often sort of almost bleed into one another, it again becomes somewhat abstract, I suppose, especially if you haven't seen it in sort of normal color daylight, and you kind of go, oh yeah, it's that shell on the beach, you know, it almost becomes this sort of abstract shape. And again, I mean, that's, you know, maybe not too far from a book cover or an album cover of a band's kind of a thing, you know. I think there's something graphical in the structure itself that sort of just lends itself to becoming cover art, yeah. Or, well, cover art in the way that it can go on your wall if you print it.
Yeah. Oh, de definitely. I definitely think it could make a cover for, book and music or whatever as well. And it's just an example of the variety of your work, 'cause obviously this new work you're working on is so different, but I like it 'cause it's so simple. There's a lot of negative space. Where did this come from then?
That's a good question, Andy. I don't sort of question these things myself. Maybe I should question them more. I think the most honest answer is just a sort of natural progression from what I've been doing over the last few years. So, you know, for me, the film photography is a really nice sort of respite from my day job of working in, you know, with a lot of the Adobe stuff, Illustrator, Photoshop, InDesign. So to have film photography be this sort of escape from that. And also, in a way, it means that I'm not tied to the computer, because obviously when you're shooting digital, you're still editing on the computer and you're uploading and you're looking at the back of a screen, the LCD on the camera. So I kind of like the fact that it sort of separates me from that world that I occupy during the day. And then the sort of longer I've been doing it, I think the more I've been enjoying simpler compositions. Yeah, I think the older I get, the more I just kind of, I sort of seek a sort of simplicity and a sort of tranquility in images. And when I see them myself and other people do, you know, sort of minimalist long exposure stuff, I'm always drawn to it. Yeah. And I can't explain it entirely, other than it's just a sort of deep down sort of connection that I have with, yeah, I guess wanting to simplify things. I don't know. Maybe that's also part of the designer. You're sort of visually problem solving. And I think you get to a point where you problem solve so much that you go, you know what? I mean, there's that classic saying, like, you know, if it's not adding anything, leave it out, as far as design is concerned. So sometimes it's almost like, okay, well, do I need color to make this picture? No. Example of the shell. It's a, you know, dark shell on a background. The image is just as effective in black and white. You go, all right, okay, you know, well then what about other things? You know, can I simplify it even more? Can I take more away to get something that feels even more evocative as an image? And I guess that's the sort of path that I'm finding myself on at the moment. And who's to say I'm going to stick with it? Because I have in the past definitely have tendencies of going down one rabbit hole before coming back up and trying something else. But at the moment, yeah, for sure. I mean, squares, medium format, black and white, and this sort of simpler approach is what has resonated with me most in my personal work. And I'll tell you what, I have given this some thought, and I think in part it is down to the sort of world that we live in as well, especially the last few years. I mean, you know, there's been so many kind of global events. I've been so sort of high octane. I mean, my wife is American, so we always have one eye on the American news. And with, you know, when Trump was president, it always seemed like there was so much happening all the time. Everything was high octane. Do you know what I mean? And then you know, we had obviously Brexit over here, and everything was always so high energy. And even nowadays, our lifestyle, you said it before as well, you know, you're always busy and there's so much to do at work. I'm the same, you know, it's almost like we're so busy all the time that what I really was seeking was a simplicity in this sort of small portion of my life that I had, which was photography. And I think that's still true today. So I kind of want to just, like, the pictures that I put on my wall, for example, is a lot of the stuff that I shoot that is very simple, you know, or even cameraless stuff that I do in the darkroom, just on the enlarger, where I just, you know, put down, you know, some shapes or some flowers and just expose it, so you get that negative space that has been left by the object that you're exposing light over. And I'm kind of drawn to this, and I think it sort of helps me, I don't know, have a sense of calm in quite a busy world. And I think that's important to me. So that, in my mind, is the best that I've come up with as far as where this has come from or why I'm doing it.
Nothing wrong with that, though. I think simplicity is a great thing, and maybe we don't have that when we first start. So maybe it's part of your journey, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. I mean, I think especially when you start out, you kind of go, I know I did anyway, where I go, oh, I want all the colors, and I need a 5-flash setup with different triggers and all this and gels on top of those. And, you know, just throw everything at it. And I think over time you sort of learn that you sort of pick the things that work for you. And then you realize that often you're happier doing less and achieving more visually speaking anyway. Yeah, I
agree. I think it's something I've very gradually learned in this last year, to spend more time on fewer things. And it's got more meaning, whether it's social media, making more images, writing, you know, anything really is. And I think some of that's through age and experience as well.
Yes, yeah, I think so. I definitely think so, yeah. For me as well, you get to a certain point where you, I mean, I'm going to make myself sound like an old man here, you know, but I kind of sort of, you know, metaphorically speaking, I sort of want to slow down a bit, you know. I don't want to feel like I have to run for the rest of my life, if you know what I mean. I kind of want to start, you know, jogging, strolling, and just, you know, slightly like looking at the world at a slower pace as well. I think there's something to be said for that. I think we're all so busy all the time, work or otherwise, family, and we live in this always on society, you know, the fact that, you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night and go, I need to remember to tax the car, you can do it right there and then. You just open your laptop and you just do it right there and then. You do your tax in your car, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, you and I both remember when you had to go down to the post office with the documents and, you know, stick it in and then get the disc and pop it in there, you know. it's we're sort of always on, so it's nice to at least acknowledge that within yourself, to go, you know what, I'm going to sort of slow things down a bit. And yeah, what better place to start than within my hobby? I mean, you know, photography for me is still a hobby, and it's, you know, it's something that should stay and needs to be something that I enjoy doing. And doing less of it in a way is a nice way to be, I think. Yeah, both compositionally, and also we spoke about this before, didn't we, about the amount of pictures that one was taking. I mean, I was, you know, you go anywhere, you know, even on a day trip out, and you come back with an SD card of like 800 images or something. It's bonkers, you know. Because nowadays, I take one roll of film, and that's it. And then I'm kind of happy. And, you know, usually medium format is 12 pictures. I might not even shoot the whole roll, you know. So I'll, you know, do 6 pictures, and then a few weeks later, do another 6. And it's kind of nice to have that delay gratification. That's definitely something that film photography has taught me as well, is to be more patient with myself, with the art, and to enjoy the fact that you don't get to see it straight away. I mean, I am terrible. I've got like a backlog of at least 20 rolls of film in the cupboard that I'm developing, and some of those definitely go back to 2019, so I need to get on that.
I don't see any issue with that. Well, I think, you know, unless you're shooting for a purpose, for a project or paid work, this is what it should be about. I love getting out old negatives from 2 or 3 years ago and then just printing them now and trying different things. So I've seen an artist piece of work that I really like, and hopefully they'll come on the show, fingers crossed. And I was looking at it, and it works so well as a photo, but actually it works even better as an exhibition. So what they've done is, say, a portrait of someone, but it's cut like this, and then each piece is slightly moved away from the other. Gradually, you know, the face could be towards the left and the arms can be towards the right.
Yeah.
And because they've done it in 3D, more or less, and cut it all up, it's a fabulous exhibition.
Wow, yeah.
And I was thinking, do you know what? This gives me an idea to try it in the dark room.
Yeah.
So I was like, right. So I wrote that down for something I can try.
How would you do it in the dark room? I'm intrigued now.
Oh, easy. I would
just mask bits of the image.
Mask it, and then I would just move the paper.
I guess that's how to do it.
That was also what I'm thinking anyway.
That's nice. Yeah, I've started to play a little bit with stuff like that. I've got a couple of masks that I use where I've done this with a couple of images, actually. In fact, I need to start posting these on social media, but sort of taking like a landscape picture, and then I cut out a circular mask that I put over. So effectively, I'm just exposing the outer part, and then I flip the paper 180 degrees so that I can then expose the center part at 180 degrees inverted. So you kind of, what is land becomes sky, and what is sky becomes land. And it's this sort of, I don't know. It's, again, this sort of abstraction of reality, I suppose.
I love that. One of the other things that stood about you was this idea of a collage then. So this to me is an amazing idea. Are they actual Polaroids of this field of like yellow flowers then?
Yeah, they are all individual shots, yeah.
Honestly, because that's such a clever idea.
Thanks. It wasn't mine. I'm not the first to do it, Andy. I want to do more of these. I've done a few of them. I want to do more of them. I mean, it's I mean, Polaroid film is expensive, so it's not a like cheap pursuit. You know, the film is about, oh, it's about like 17, £18 for a pack of film. You only get eight exposures on that, and chances are half of them are going to be, like, you know, overexposed, unexposed, or duds. So you sort of have to commit to it. But I mean, you could do it in a different medium. You know, you could shoot it in film or even digital. The first person that I saw this doing was actually an English artist called David Hockney, who, you know, is a famous painter. He's from, I think he's from the north somewhere. I know there's a gallery in Saltaire, I think, has a lot of his images. Anyway, he's a painter and photographer. Did a lot of photography in the sort of 80s, 90s, a lot of which was Polaroid photography. So he started this, and he called them the Joiners series because it all sort of joins up, obviously. So he'd take pictures of, and there's an amazing one of his mum, and he's just got this, you know, quite a close look on every aspect of her. And every Polaroid is like an eye, a nose, another eye, a forehead, you know, and it sort of builds up this whole collage. And they're like often like 100 Polaroid pictures. I mean, he must have burned through film like nothing else. And he's done the whole, and he's done it with like sort of swimming pools in LA and, you know, these big landscapes as well, where he just kind of keeps taking pictures and joins it all up. And I saw that, you know, the first time when I started going to art school, I guess, again, late 90s, early 2000s. And again, you kind of go, wow, that's very cool. I want to try that. So I remember trying it back in the day and doing it with 35 millimeter film. So you just shoot a whole roll of, you know, a friend of yours or so, and just kind of do 36 exposures of like everything, you know, head, nose, there you are. And then you get the prints back, you know, get them quite nice and big. So sort of, I say nice, you know, 7x5, for example, and then put them all together. And you've got like a life-size version of your friend. It's amazing.
That's a good idea.
So you can do like almost sort of cardboard cutout, like, you know, life size versions of your friends.
See, even that is another idea for me to explore.
I remember it as well. It's sort of, now that you mention it, it takes me back. I was in the States. This is probably like 15 years ago now. So, and I was at the Golden Gate Bridge, and I had a fresh roll of film that I was going to put in to start taking pictures. And I thought, everyone's going to take this picture in the same way. And obviously, I took that picture as well of just shooting, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge as, you know, wide, sort of, you know, 24 millimeter or something. You get everything in with the bay and all of it, you know, great. And I think I had a zoom lens at the time, and I sort of put it onto the other end. So it might have been like 105 mil or something like that. And you obviously just get, you know, kind of more detailed versions of it. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to shoot the whole roll like this now. So I'm going to shoot the whole bridge with just these sections. And then when I got back and had the film developed and prints made, I even collaged the whole thing up. And for years, it was framed in our living room, and it was, you know, massive. It was, you know, sort of like a meter and a half by a meter tall. But it was this whole scene of the Golden Gate Bridge made up of 36 exposures. It wasn't anywhere near the sort of quality of David Hockney's work, but it was certainly inspired by that. And even then, I like the fact that, because I didn't, I just set the camera on auto, I think, here. So, you know, you're sort of metering. The metering would be different for the sky than it would for, you know, bits of foreground or the bridge. So some areas are blown out and some of them are too dark. And I kind of like that patchwork feel to it.
That's a great idea.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, David Hockney, what a genius.
Yeah, I've lost the thing with him, isn't it? I think the hardest thing I'm thinking though is, depending on how many frames you do, that is a lot of printing to do in the dark room.
It becomes, I mean, a that, and also just while you're doing it, you know, I mean, the thing that you pulled from my Instagram feed is obviously that sort of 3x3. So, and it's got a level horizon. So you go up three, and then horizon one, two, three, and then another three above that. But when you've got irregular subjects and, you know, more pictures, you've got to think sharp about, well, I started top left corner and I'm working my way down to bottom right. You know, how do you go? You know, how do you break that grid up? You know, and to then go, all right, okay. So when you get them all back, you go, oh, I'm sort of missing half an arm or something. You know, if you take a picture of a person, that is, of course, you
Well,
know, it's a
the other
building.
thing
Like, oh,
is,
there's a bit of a building missing now, you know.
yeah, I mean, obviously, the other thing though is your viewfinder isn't 100%.
Yeah, correct.
So you've really got to know your camera.
And the other thing is that you're getting, depending on how you're pointing, I mean, that was shot with an SX70, which I think it's probably about 35 mil, 40 mil lens on that. And so things look different, obviously, when they're closer to you than when they're far away. So as you're panning down onto the ground, things start kind of looking different than when they're further away. So yeah, distortion it sort of plays into it as well. Yeah, so you've got to be, yeah, I think you're better off using a longer focal length and just buying into this idea that you're creating this mosaic kind of, and you just, basically cover yourself by shooting everything twice in a way. I think with that, for example, even though it's only nine shots, so you get eight pictures to a box of Polaroid. So I had to use two boxes anyway, but I'm pretty sure I probably shot about three or four boxes of Polaroid of all the same stuff, just to make sure that I've got ones where I can line up the horizon, because they're actually all, and you'll see all the pictures are just, on my coffee table. And the horizon works pretty well, but not all of them did. So I kind of wanted to make sure that at least that was covered and I didn't have too many, jaggedness in the horizon, as it were.
That's because I was thinking another thing. If you shot this with negatives, let's say, you cut your negatives up like most of us do to styro 'em, you're
Yeah.
either going to cut them in fives or sixes. So you've got to think of that as well, because you don't want to cut them up in individuals. So you'd have to.
You could do, but gosh, then you print every individual picture. You've got to then, guillotine the print, I guess, or cut it somehow. Those together. I have seen, and I honestly I can't remember, but who the artist was now, but it blew my mind, where someone had did this basically on 35 millimeter, but they'd worked out. So I think it was actually a picture of like it was like the Eiffel Tower or like the Leaning Tower of Pisa or some kind of historic piece of architecture. Maybe it was even like Oxford and it was like the Radcliffe camera or something. But they worked out that over 36 exposures, they'd worked out they put the camera in portrait mode and shot the whole thing so that every negative was that part of it. And they literally cut it, like you said, into, I think, four or five strips and then just contact printed those. And it made up the entire image because they'd worked out, I'm going to do one, two, three, four, five, six, top to bottom. One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. And I know I've got them all. And you can contact print the whole thing as one big, it's probably bigger than 8x10. But yeah, amazing to see when it all lines up and you've done it all in camera, basically. Yeah.
Jesus, that's see again.
Think it's one of those things, isn't it? Either that worked the first time round and they were just, it's like,
Just
wow,
amazing.
that worked great, or the amount of rolls of film that had to be pushed through that camera in order to get that final contact printed. And what you're looking at as a photographer, because it's not messed with, because every negative is on a strip and it touches, obviously. So other than cutting it to make up the next row, it's as honest as it gets. Yeah, it wasn't, oh well, I swapped that one in with another one from another set, like me with my Polaroids, for example, where I shot four boxes of film to get nine pictures.
It's a
And
really
it's
good
something again,
idea.
like the sort of the levels of creativity that we have at our disposal, or that people seem to have at their disposal in photography, is it blows my mind. And it's something that keeps me, you sort of engage with the art form. Well, it has been for the last 20 years, and there's always another thing that I go, wow, that just is amazing. Yeah. And it then either spurs me on to try something similar, and it sort of gives you these brain waves of trying something else, or you don't, you just go, well, I just like the fact that I was able to see this, and that's amazing, and awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing medium, and I think it's an amazing hobby that is so different to so many others.
Yeah.
And I.
Yeah, and this is it, I think, for me as well. It is. Yeah, it sort of it runs this whole, gamut of possibilities, photography, and it can and has meant a lot of different things to me at different points in my life. Everything from, yeah, it's a work thing because I need to organize a model shoot for a book cover and I'm earning money with it, through to, oh, I just like to have an evening by myself in town, taking pictures of very very familiar sights, and just try and see if I can frame them in a different way. And sometimes, honestly, Andy, it's even just like a mental health thing, I think, for myself and for a lot of people, where and I think that's, you know, that's testament is the role of the film that I haven't developed, because I just go out and shoot, and it sort of it becomes a thing to do, and it keeps you engaged with your surroundings and where you live and where you want to go and travel and all these things. And it can really help for me, definitely, as a mental health thing, to just go, you know what, I'm just going to spend an afternoon, grab a camera, and just shoot a roll of film.
I think that's one of the best things about it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole reason I set up my Facebook group, because I didn't want to do just another photography group. The whole idea of it is literally just therapy for people.
Yeah.
And it was really nice, actually, this week, after writing that article I did about importance of friendships.
Yeah.
Someone joined the group, and the only thing he said was, that was a really nice blog article. Well, you know, congratulations. And I was like, oh, thank you. That's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. But it can mean the world, can't it, to have that feedback, even if it's, you know,
a
single person that kind of reaches out to you to go, you know, I appreciate what you did, and it sort of helped me as well. And, you know, it's nice to hear people, you know, express these sentiments like you did, you know, about friendship and how we feel about things at times. And I think us as photographers, we're quite sort of, you know, a lot of us are quite sensitive creatures anyway, I think.
Yeah.
And it's a nice way to be in. I think it's a nice vehicle, photography, you know, like I said, in a sort of mental health way, as well as something that can be, you know, your career path and earn you, you know, if you're very successful, lots of money, you know. But it can be quite a simple thing as well, and it connects people.
Mm. Yeah, without a doubt. Well, I think we're through the formal part of the interview, Steve, to be honest. And you know what's coming, don't you?
Not really.
No, not really. So we're going to take you through my random questions.
Go on.
Are you sitting comfortably?
As comfortably as I will be this evening, yep.
Yeah. Okay, so... start with this one. Right. You have been asked to name a new city. What would you call it?
Wow. I mean, it will probably depend on the size of the city. You know, you don't want to, you know, you're not going to call a sort of big metropolis something like, you know, Littleville or something. Or maybe you would, ironically, I don't know. I definitely wouldn't call it anything that sort of echoes myself or that has reference to myself. So I wouldn't call it, you know, Steveville or anything like that. I think I would I think this is a designer in me, I would try and find something that is appropriate of the city of where it is, you know, so kind of have something that references the location and the surrounding areas and is sort of sympathetic of where it is rather than the sort of size of it, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
Mm. No, so, yeah, nice.
No concrete answer as far as the name is concerned, unfortunately, but but I think I would want to be mindful of where it is, and yeah, I think it should be named according to the location and be mindful of where it sits in the world.
Yeah, because there are some very strange names of some, especially villages in this country, shall we say.
Yes.
So it does make you wonder. And obviously you've got to think about the future, haven't you? Because words have different meanings in different periods as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I know, yeah, I'm sure someone published a book of like, weirdest names in the UK, and there is a lot of things.
yeah, they're quite comical, that's for sure. Right, yeah. Okay.
Quite colourful language as well. Some of them quite rude.
yeah, they were a good laugh. I grant you that. Would you prefer one eye and two mouths or one eye and two noses?
I love this. This is great. Would I prefer? Well, say that again. Would I
So
prefer?
you got one eye and two mouths, or one eye and two noses.
One eye and two mouths, or what? So it's always going to be one eye. You're definitely only going to be a cyclops. I think I go with one eye and two noses, honestly. I think I go one eye, two noses.
You prefer the sense of smell.
Yeah, well, that wasn't my immediate thinking. So my line of thinking was I wouldn't want two mouths on my face that could both be having an argument, basically. I think I sort of have, quite a lot of like internal monologues anyway. I mean, I work by myself all day, so you kind of get quite good at, sort of entertaining yourself with your own thoughts. And, I mean, obviously there's external influence like radio playing or so. And now, obviously, the last year, my wife has been working at home as well. But we have two separate rooms. I mean, she works in the bedroom and I have a little office space here. And yeah, I think if I had two mouths, I mean, oh God, honestly, I drive myself mad here. So I'd rather have the ability to smell better or smell more accurately in my mind than the ability to talk even more crap than I do.
It's amazing where these questions go. I think we find a little bit out about our personalities here, don't
Absolutely,
we?
yeah, absolutely. Whether we want to or not.
Exactly. No, that's cool. So the Matrix question, the blue or red pill, blue is Alice in Wonderland, or red is wake up and live a lie.
Oh wow. Okay, so blue is basically like your sort of fantasy reality, but you're never really in reality. That's a very good question.
Live a
I would
lie.
very much be tempted by the blue pill, the Alice in Wonderland scenario. I would be tempted by it. And I think, yeah, and in a sort of moment of want for ultimate and unlimited happiness, even if it is a wonderful lie. I don't know. I'd probably go the blue pill, but I don't know. Let me tell you this. I used to post a lot of stuff on Flickr, and I used to have a sort of a group on there, as in your group of your pictures, not a sort of group with other people in. And that was titled The Escapist, because a lot of my stuff that I was doing as I was coming out of college, especially with the sort of digital manipulation, was quite sort of escapist and surreal and fantastical with, floating heads and all this kind of stuff, and sort of quite sort of bizarre things. And I always liked this idea of escaping to another world. So I think that's also why I ended up doing book covers for fantasy and young adult and science fiction, because it has a massive draw, that there's a serious draw on this sort of surreal and otherworldly and this sort of escapist thing.
That's
I
interesting.
guess the question is, or the sort of, the underlying question is, there's would you be happy to live a lie? That's what we're getting at, isn't it? I feel like I'm cheating myself out of the reality that is by going, I'll take the blue pill and go Alice in Wonderland, but I think I'd probably do that. I don't know. I don't mind living in dreams.
No, that's fair enough. No, that's good.
It's a good question, though. It is a good question, yeah.
It's asked so many different places, and you see it all over. So, okay. So,
It's interesting. Now, I mean, we could talk about this question alone for another hour. It is interesting because if you think about it, or if I think about it, to me, photography is a part of escapism. It is kind of taking
totally.
away from my day job, and even quite deliberately so, where I don't want to spend time on computers and I don't want to spend time with digital machinery, so I'm going to do this whole thing manually shooting film. And it is a form of escapism, so it's something that I definitely enjoy.
It's surprising, But everyone is different in that sense. Some people it is an escape, because that's their day job then. So
yeah, true, true, of course. And for some people, it, you know, it's a different thing altogether, where photography can be, you know, they're like a forensic photographer for the police or something, and they might, you know, they might want to sort of get away from that because it's very technical and full on, and you know, it sort of puts you into another world entirely, and yeah, that you might want to move away from that in the hobby side of things. I don't know. I don't know. It's an interesting question, and I think, yeah, fundamentally, photography allows us a form of escapism. So I think a lot of creatives would be tempted by the blue pill. That's a sweeping statement and a gross generalization. I know that, but it feels like an honest statement for myself anyway. Yeah.
I think so for creatives. No,
Yeah.
I can understand
Yeah.
that. Okay, so a new law is passed, and you can only own one picture in your house. What do you choose?
Okay, I think that's kind of easy. I don't know. Is it easy? My immediate thought went to, we have a picture, my wife and I have a picture of us on our wedding day that was taken by a friend of ours, friend of mine, again, photographer, who shot our wedding. And it was, so the picture is probably sort of like 12 by 16 or so in portrait orientation. And it is a really, really nice picture of us on our, you know, special day. So I think for that reason alone, I would choose that picture. It's also been the one that's probably been with us the most constant, always up since we got married 10 years ago. So, you know, other pictures have come and gone on the wall, but I think that's always been a constant. The other thing is the picture is mounted. So obviously, because this photographer, she shot the wedding, and then, you know, a couple of, you know, sort of weeks later, the pictures came back, and then we picked one that we wanted to put on our wall, and that is the one that we picked of Jess and myself. But what we did in the meantime, we bought a piece of mount board for it that we had on an easel at our actual wedding. So we knew we were going to do this, and we got everyone to sign the easel, sorry, the mount board that was on this easel with a message. We had a little sort of just a sketch drawing of us two, like little stick figures in there, going, "There's going to be a picture in here, and you're going to have all your messages around it." So it's, we've got it properly framed in this nice sort of brass finish frame. And the mount has all the guests have their signatures and their little sentiments on there. So I think, yeah, as a piece, the photograph and the whole sort of story that goes with it, that is probably the most valuable image to me, and everything else can go. Yeah.
No, that's interesting. That's really nice as well to have that sort of memory, I think.
I'm also glad I remember this, because if I said anything else and my wife listens to the podcast, she'd probably have me.
That's fair enough. Right, okay. So your last one then is you get to give a punch, a present, or have a pint with each of the following.
Oh, okay.
So
Punch,
you've
present, pint. All right.
punch, present, and pint. You've got
Gotcha.
Steven Spielberg, Steven Seagal,
Okay.
and Steven Tyler.
Oh, okay. This should be fairly quick.
Okay.
So, moving back, okay. I punch Steven Seagal because I think, A, he can take it, let's be honest. I mean, he must have punched a few people in his time.
Yeah.
Also, not the biggest Steven Seagal fan myself.
No.
I'm not really that big on action films to start with, so yeah, I'd probably punch him. I would. What's the other ones?
You got pint and present.
Present. Okay, I'd go. I definitely go. I give Steven Spielberg the present because I like his films. I sort of grew up with his films. You know, I think we all did, didn't we? Growing up. One of my earliest memories is seeing E.T. in a drive-in cinema. Yeah, literally one of the earliest memories. I must have been like 5, 6 or something. Yeah, I was, you know, in the car with my parents and watching E.T. Sort of frightened me at the time, but it stuck with me. And then obviously everything else, you know, Jaws, Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, everything. Yeah. So definitely Steven Spielberg gets a present. And Steven Tyler, I would have a pint with him because he's a rock star. I quite like Aerosmith. I'm a, you know, fan of the music. I used to play music myself, actually. I used to play guitar. So, yeah, I definitely like an evening with Steven Tyler could be interesting. So, I definitely have a pint with him. Yeah, I'm sure it would lead to more than one pint as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Well, thank you
Well,
so
yeah,
much.
that's a good question with a good lineup of Steves.
Exactly, yeah.
Well done. Yeah, well done finding all those.
Well, thank you so much for going through them, Steve. That's appreciated.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
No, that's not a problem. Do you want to tell all of the listeners where to check you out, your website and your social?
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, like anyone these days, best place is probably Instagram. All the film photography stuff is under SMR Photo Art. And then I have a website as well, which is smrphotoart.com. That being said, it's an old website, and I was using that for more of the design work at the time. It needs an update, and the plan is to update that to a photography-only website where I'm going to start offering some of these darkroom prints that I've been doing as well in very small numbers, so never more than sort of half a dozen or so, and then potentially down the line even start doing limited numbered runs. So it's something that is on the horizon for me to start, making use of the prints that I've got and, trying to get them into people's hands that might appreciate them. Other than that, if you're interested in design work, design by smr.com, and similarly there's an Instagram handle there as well, which is again design by smr.
Great stuff. Thank you for that. And then obviously my last question, I do this pay it forward scheme. Is there anyone you could think of that I maybe should check out, whether it's for an interview or check out their work that you think's really nice?
I mean, it's one of those. It's a great question, and I know you ask this to people, and it's always hard to sort of recommend one over another in a way. I mean, even just people to look at. I mean, I sort of like everyone else. I'm sort of, I do watch quite a bit of YouTube content from people, and there's a Spanish American photographer called Adrian Vila or Villa. He goes under the initials only of AOWS. So his website is AOWS.co, I think, for or whatever it is. It'll be one of the like states in America. I don't know. And again, on YouTube and on Instagram, he's just AOWS. You'll see why I like his work. And if you can get him on the show, I think you should. He's a very sort of softly spoken, but a great, great black and white photographer, and presents a lot of his work in square format. Used to shoot exclusively film, square medium format on a Bronica, which I shoot as well. He now also shoots digital, but everything is always presented as square and in black and white. And there's just some really, really lovely scenes. So yeah, if you're not familiar with him, or even the listeners who are listening to this, I definitely recommend him. There's another one which is probably, closer to home. There's a local chap here in Oxford called Rory Dunn, who is he's very young. I mean, I met him when he was only like 19 years old or something, like a couple of years ago. And he does he's on Instagram as Rory Dunn Photography, or just Rory Dunn. But he does portraits, and that's starting to do some fashion stuff as well. He's kind of on this road of, in my mind, becoming a great fashion photographer, but he shoots a lot of film. He shoots some digital as well, but even the digital stuff, he kind of, it looks like film anyway. I don't know how he does it. I think maybe it's like old, using old lenses or whatever. But and he shoots a lot of sort of, he's done some recent stuff with like Lomo purple film, and sort of embraces the whole sort of alternative processes, but always with, portraiture, and good one at that, especially for a young photographer at his age. So yeah, definitely one to look out for in coming years. And he's Oxford based. He's not too far from me. I met him, yeah, last year it was actually. We were in touch before, and I sort of, knew about him through social media. And then we met on a photo walk and sort of kept in touch ever since. And it'd be nice to catch up with him actually once this is all blown over one way or another.
That's
But yeah,
interesting.
there's one, if there's, yeah, two people I'd say, yeah, local talent, Rory Dunn, and on a sort of, more national scale, international scale even, is Adrian Vila or Villa.
Great stuff. Thanks for that, Steve. That's appreciated. So, all I can say is thanks a lot for spending this time with me, and showing us your work, to be honest. It's lovely.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Andy, for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, it's been nice to, like you said as well, you kind of make friends in this community. And the fact that we sort of first connected on social media, and then you invited me onto the show, it's, yeah, I mean, I feel truly humbled, honestly. It's such an honor to be among some of the illustrious people that you've interviewed over the last few years by now as well, you've said. It's very humbling. Thank you so much for having me.
No, not a problem at all.